Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 160. Buddhism 101. Polite and humorous rudeness.
You know, the Dalai Lama's special lineage of, you know, his whole thing about my religion is kindness, you know, and the open-heartedness is the solution for the world, and a world peace to inner peace, all of that sort of thing. It comes through from the Bodhisattva Manjushri, which is who's kind of like the angel of wisdom, and then through an Indian writer called Shantideva, especially, who changed his name to Shantideva, which means the god of peace, so that people would feel peaceful just hearing his name. You know? Before that, he had a rather more rude name that he was given as a student, because he seemed to be a dropout student. People thought he was really ignorant, didn't know anything when he was in school, Shantideva. And they gave him a rather rude name of Busuku. It was called Busuku. He who eats, sleeps, and defecates. That was what they called it. Because they thought that was all he did. His great teaching is, the anger is a really bad thing for us and for the world, you know. And the root of anger is frustration. And when you see something happening that you feel shouldn't be happening, or when something that you think should be happening is being blocked from happening, you feel frustrated. And then you nurse that frustration, and it builds up, and then you blow up, you know. Then because you feel that you can't do anything in your calm mode, the anger comes to you in your own voice and says, this is unacceptable, and I can't do it, that's not terrible. And you can't resist it because it's your own voice in your own mind, and then you blow up your temper. And, you know, women in our country are socialized to sort of be polite and don't speak up, and men blab away, and they often go down like one paragraph after another of stupid things. Stupid statements. And then the women like feel more and more frustrated as this idiotic blabbering goes on, and then they blow up. So my wife is a master, I think, you know, of what I call creative and humorous rudeness, and interrupts right away when she's still in a good mood. And then when you get interrupted like that, like, well, why don't you shut up before we're both pissed off? Then you kind of, it's all right, because there's no heat in it. And then you, of course, you feel, if you're a man, you feel, well, how come I'm not being listened to, and I'm interrupted, because we're socialized to think that we're dominant, you know, not realizing that we're actually the lesser half, you know, and often out to lunch, you know. And so that's the example you take. So in honor of that, that's good, but I don't even know what is the question. I'm happy to honor my better half. We just celebrated our 50th anniversary this summer. And we were, this summer, and we were voted by all our mutual friends when we got together as the least likely to succeed, the ex-monk and the ex-model. And each one thought, like, the monk friends thought, what is he doing with the model? And the model friends thought, that guy has no style. Like, what is, he has a shaved head and whatever. Anyway. So we made it through 50 years, and I do miss her. She's in Woodstock in the Catskills, where we are. But she's taking care of things there. Mammonocracy. And the Dalai Lama asked me when I was saying that I wanted him not to resign, you know, as the head of the Tibetan state, you know, in exile at the moment, but eventually back in Tibet when the Chinese leadership comes to their senses, which I'm sure they will soon. And I asked, you know, I said, you shouldn't really quit, you know, being a head of state. But you don't have to work. You can just do your studies and whatever. You're just a symbol, like the king of Norway or something, you know, or the queen of England. He says, I don't want to be a prisoner like Lady Di. So I said, well, you don't have to be, but you really, they need you, the Tibetans, because, you know, they need a spiritual thing. Mm. And don't think that America is a really democracy. Mm. America is a theocracy. What do you mean? He says, how is it a democracy? I said, no. It's a mammonocracy, I said. We worship money there, and money controls everything at the moment and ruins everything, the absolute deification of money. Mm. And that's what ruins the healthcare system, of course. Yeah. In the Tibetan medicine, when you study, I studied Tibetan medicine at the insistence of my old root guru, a Mongolian gentleman, when I was a monk. And I studied it. And in Tibetan medicine, they say, if you want to be a doctor, and you're doing it for profit or fame or status, you're going to be a lousy doctor, and you're not going to be successful, and you're going to be frustrated. Mm. But if you do it for compassion, and here's the method, you know, in the, you know, hours of course hours, you know, in a Tibetan medical school, there's like many hours of the course of compassion. Mm. It's something you learn to cultivate. And, you know, the Tibetan, the Buddhists from India, actually, and carried on and refined in Tibet, are really very good at that. But, and then it says, if you go into healing and medicine out of compassion, then you actually will be wealthy and famous, and you'll have high status, because people will really appreciate what you do. But it cannot be your motivation. Mm. And it's a marvelous thing, and so you actually study compassion. Now, just to say that, I think I should say one thing, since you all are hard-working, healing people, or most of you, is that compassion doesn't just come from kind of like, oh, I feel so sad for you and sorry for you. That's called compassion that has a notion of love, it says, or affection. It's notional affection or sentimental affection, and is not necessarily very effective. The compassion that becomes genuine has to do with, it has three levels, and one of them is, it's always combined with wisdom, and it comes from wisdom. Mm. And the first one is, it combines with the wisdom of impermanence. And then second, it combines with the wisdom of what they call personal selflessness. And third, it combines with the wisdom of what they call objective selflessness. And what that means is that when the basic sickness that human beings have, according to the Buddha's, you know, medical insight, actually, rather than religious, is that people are wired to think that they have a fixed identity in the center of themselves, that is something separate from and isolated from the world. So relating to the world becomes kind of problematic. And when they especially feel vulnerable or something, they can withdraw into this safe place that is disconnected and never changes. And you can find that in yourself with a tiny bit of contemplation. When you look at a picture of yourself like 20 years ago at a picnic, when you're a completely different person, and yet you go, if you can go back into the memory of the event, you then have, when you click on it, it's like, oh yeah, I was just the same as I am now then. Mm. And you identify with that. So there's something in the base of your perception, of your memory and your experience, that doesn't change. We all feel that, mm. you know, unless we're enlightened, and or to some degree. And that's where wisdom comes in. When you investigate yourself with wisdom, which means you don't meditate on selflessness or emptiness, you meditate on finding that feeling of an unchanging real me that is really different from everything else in the universe. Mm. And then when you do that, you won't be able to find it, they say. Although they're always open-minded. As the Dalai Lama is always ready. Like, if you find absolute self in there, by all means, let us know. We've been barking up a wrong tree for thousands of years. But basically, you won't find it, and people haven't found it. And what you find then is that you're empty of any non-relational element in yourself. And when you find that, you suddenly feel a kind of, you know, what you said, dependent origination, but actually the better word is really relativity. And you realize that you are that your sense of separateness from beings is kind of arbitrary boundarying that you do out of habit or, you know, self-protection or self, you know, whatever, trauma. It gets even worse. You get more isolated. And that there's no real boundary between you and others. And therefore, that's why when you fall in love, you kind of really feel the feeling of the beloved, you know, and you become very focused on it. It becomes like the main thing for you. Or when a mother with a child, you know, the Buddha is always mentioned, you know, like they say an enlightened being is like a mother, sees every other being like a mother sees her only beloved child, you know. And so then naturally from sort of your own transparency, in other words, you look into yourself and you sort of become transparent to your own inner vision, and then you don't really find that anything in yourself that's an absolute, except in your relationships. And then you see everybody else when you don't get clogged inside yourself. And then you automatically become more empathetic. And of course, human beings in general, from Buddhist biological point of view, Buddhists had their own Darwin, and his name was Buddha. And he was not worried about monkeys and chimpanzees and genes and crocodiles and whatever at all. It was not a big, you know, like those people in Texas who do creationism, you know, they're really upset about being related to some monkey. They don't want to. And the male doesn't want to be related to a female, you know, the Texan guy, you know, what. But the Buddhist Darwin didn't mind. Not only are we related to them, we personally have been monkeys, every single one of us. And if we behave like a monkey in this life, we'll be one another time, which is not really good. You can't really get on Facebook as a monkey, you know. And you can't really chat with people, you know. They just go, you know. So, and worse than a monkey, actually, from Buddhist biological point of view, where the individual mind, which is not really individual in a metaphysical sense, but still is yourself, your relative self, you know, it's infinitely malleable and doesn't end and never becomes nothing, and therefore you are a work in progress with an infinite future ahead of you, and therefore every little bit that you do that's a little bit better has an infinite positive consequence, so don't be discouraged just because you're going to die. Everybody's going to die, but what you've done that's good is you, and you'll reap the fruit of that. I know a lot of you are scientific, and therefore you think that modern science has discovered that the human mind doesn't go on after death. You think that's a discovery. But I ask you, anybody who thinks that, who has discovered nothing? And do they expect a Nobel Prize for that? Oh, I discovered nothing. Actually, isn't nothing the one thing no one is ever going to discover? Is there any evidence for the existence of nothing? Will there ever be such an evidence? We have a law of thermodynamics. Energy never is destroyed, right? Isn't that a law of thermodynamics? Is your consciousness some kind of energy? Is it no energy? Then it means it's already nothing. But you definitely know it isn't nothing right now, right? So you're all, never mind, you know, don't get too worn out and burnt out about healing and curing people, because you're not going to get away from your patients even if you die, or they do. You're going to meet them in the next life, and you're going to have to keep healing them. So you better cultivate your compassion, which will naturally will do when you develop the wisdom of relativity, that you are a relational being, you're capable of being identifying with other beings. That's a human nature. Human is extremely resilient and flexible. That's the greatness of the human being. Why Buddha made such a fuss about human beings, because we are the most educable of beings, you know, that of life forms that they are. We can criticize ourselves. We can see through us. Men can learn to listen to their wives. Well, the basis is what's called the royal reason of relativity in Buddhism. It's considered sort of advanced, but it's not complicated. It's very easy. In other words, anything that you experience is relative. And then, you know, people have experiences that they feel are very absolute. And one that you know that you have, unless you're saintly, and I'm actually probably many of you are, but one of the things that is when you yourself lose your temper and burst into fury, the impulse to do something like shout or strike or, you know, say, you know, whatever it is, that when you really lose your temper, feels like irresistible to you, doesn't it? It's like something comes from an absolute place inside yourself. I have to say this. I have to say that guy's such a turkey, or you know, whatever it is. You know, and you break things that are valuable to you, and you say things you don't mean to people that you love, and so on. And then you're very sorry about it later. But it takes you over and makes you the tool something that seems to be absolute to you. Mm. But this is where the royal reason of relativity comes in. Mm. It's a logical thing. Buddhists are not just staring at the wall, I'm meditating, and that's going to cure everything. That wouldn't cure a single thing. Mm. It would temporarily give you a little peace, you'd stare at the wall for a while. But then you get mad later when somebody comes and disturbs you or steps on your toe, you're sitting around. What do you mean? I'm staring at the wall, don't bother me. And the point is, because you experience something as if it were absolute, it's relative. Mm. You know that logically. And absolute means non-relative, therefore no relative person can experience an absolute. Mm. Right? But that's logical. It's simple. Mm. Right? It's like no one can be nothing. None of you are going to ever be nothing. I love to say this. We're supposed to be talking a little bit about death, right? Mm. Tonight. So, you know what? No one gets out of here a dead. That's my slogan. Usually it's no one gets out of here alive, right? In this case, no one gets out of here a dead. So everything will follow you again, and you are going to go through it all again. That Bill Murray is a guru of all time. You know? What was it called? Yes. He kept having to do it over and over and over until he decided to be a bodhisattva. And he helped the old lady. He didn't hit the person with the ladder. He did everything right, you know. He became a compassionate person, you know. Mm. And that's actually a little bit our fate. Mm. And you scientific people who think that's crazy or that's religious, what you have to really face is the fact that the belief in nothingness, that it awaits you, that is the real condition of you, of your mind, is blind faith belief. Mm. It's a fundamentalist belief, because no one will ever know it. Carl Sagan will not show up, you know, on a sequel to Cosmos and say, hey guys, I really don't exist, it's cool. You can get out of here by dying, and you don't have to worry about anything. He's not going to do it, and he didn't do it. And of course, no one will ever do it. So you're always going to be here. So therefore, your behavior, everything becomes more serious about your behavior. And that's how you do every day. You know, you lose your temper, you feel burned out, but it's relational. And so you take a break, you don't lose it, you calm down, you see it from another perspective. You know, you develop skills that are actually in this light. Remember that people wrongly define enlightenment as like Einstein, boom, a big light bulb goes off in their head or something. They think that's what it is. That's not what enlightenment is. That could make somebody more egotistical than ever. Enlightenment is becoming truly compassionate and selfless. Mm. And therefore, the female is ahead of the male. Guys, I'm sorry. They are way ahead of us, you know. They are so kind that they are willing to accept residency of a complete stranger in their belly without rent, no rent, and they'll be there for almost a year, and then that stranger will come out with a tremendously difficult, you know, labor, which is usually uncompensated. There's no overtime, and then it's going to start, you know, devouring them, and they will like burst into milk. And which guy is going to do that? The guys don't even want to be in the labor room, except of course modern dads do. You know, actually we had four children, and three of them they kicked me out, but the last one I did get in, and then you know, I did faint. They put a chair under me there. The nurse was so hip. She slipped a chair around me, like, you know, what? And then nobody told me that they were blue. Then while I was fainting, I was thinking, well, we'll just say he's a little baby Krishna, never mind. Then he turned pink, luckily, by the time I regained consciousness. And so enlightenment, if you define it like that, it's a very different story. And therefore, when you know, I have another slogan, Buddha is as Buddha does. And so if you control your temper, and if you control your obsession, and you control your determination that you're always right, and you know this and know that, and you're ready to see this from another perspective, then you are developed. That is compassion. And mm. That is positive movement. And since we always change all the time anyway, if we don't change in a positive way, we're probably deteriorating. watching CNN and realizing that insanity has taken center stage on this in this society. Talk about needing therapy. I won't say any more. Yes.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing series Buddhism 101, using classic recordings from the archives of Robert Thurman to elucidate basic concepts of the tradition, and was originally recorded September 11th, 2017, at the event hosted by Foundation for the Sacred Stream called Learning from Dying, Buddhist Understandings of Consciousness and Death. To learn more about this event, Foundation for the Sacred Stream, or about upcoming events with Bob and Issa, please visit bobthurman.com. To watch the full panel recording from this event, please visit University of California Television at UCTV.tv. Use with permission, all rights reserved. And now back to Bob and Issa with the second half of this week's podcast.
Hi, Bob. Following up on your comment about reincarnation.
Yes.
So His Holiness has said that reincarnation is not just a tenet of faith in Buddhist thought,
yes,
but it is the result of empirical inquiry.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could tell me what he means by this, if you could extrapolate on that statement.
Right. Well, you know, the root reason, the root thing is that thing about nothing is nothing, you know, eureka, you know. The human mind reifies concepts, you know, and we feel that if we have a concept for something, it must be there. So we are people who go around, we have a concept nothing, you know, we have a concept chair, and there's seems to be a referent for chair. So we have a concept nothing, and we think there must be a referent. So we think of a dark space, you know, and we think that's where we're going. And it's going to be nice, and we'd like it because, of course, at night we like to sleep. Nobody's scared of falling asleep. You do lose consciousness. You lose control of your environment. You hope it's, you know, you lock the door maybe and turn off the light and make no sound. But, you know, nobody's scared of becoming nothing. Nobody's scared of having no feelings and no consciousness. People who believe that they won't exist after death think that's really brave of them. But it's not brave to be nothing. You start pulling my tooth and make me nothing, you know. Okay, bring down the anesthetic, we say. But we do it because all of us are lulled into a certain thing by this concept of materialism, dogma of materialism, where we think, well, après moi le déluge, as the French king said, you know, the disaster will happen after me, you know. You know, and therefore we care, sure, oh, my grandchildren, I really care. But we don't care enough to demand cheap Teslas faster. And so it's easy to make the switch. We shouldn't say, oh, we can't fix the health system. Oh, no. That's where we're brainwashed, right? But we are complacent in this country, you know, because we think, after all, finally it's all nothing. Finally I'll get out of it. You know, I call it the circuit breaker. When you're making a huge effort to be different, to be better, to restrain your negativities, say at some point there's an inner stress of your self-restraint versus your impulse and your habit, and something goes like click, like a circuit breaker. Mm. And that click we express in our American lingo like, go for it, or let it all hang out. Or we even say with great courage, what the hell? Because we're not afraid of, we don't listen to Garrison Keillor's wonderful Buddhist phrase that the Lutherans say to each other all the time, it could be worse. Which makes them insist on, even in the smallest way, making it better. Because there's everybody's scot-free That's a psychotic thing to think there's no consequence to how you live and what you do. That's basically kind of subliminal psychosis. I'm sorry. But that is Buddhist analysis. So the point is, if there's total relativity, you're related to everything forever, you're forced to absolutely use all your force and power and concentration to make everything just a tiny bit better. I'm sorry, but I really like that one. I do. So, you know, and it's little things, baby steps. That's another Bill Murray teaching. What about Bob? Did you ever see What About Bob? Yeah. If not, that's homework. You should go see What About Bob. You know, he goes around with his little fish in a plastic bag, you know, and he, baby steps. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go meditate for 10 years and do this and that. Just a little bit change, you know, a little, you know, if you lose your temper, like instead of 4 minutes, you lose for two, you know. You just a little bit. That's a huge achievement, because also you can go downhill bit by bit and really easily too. So you, when you know that, you make sure that you're always going uphill. That's the practice of compassion. Like the Dalai Lama likes to say, I still lose my temper, but now it blows over really quickly. He said, right? But he doesn't really much lose it. He's not. He's pretty. He's kind of cute. He's really quite sweet.
So Bob, His Holiness has said that reincarnation is not just a tenet of Buddhist faith.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Lost track. Yes. Well, you see, the thing is, Carl Sagan might come back. You know, Carl Sagan might come back as a graduate student somewhere, you know. And he might have a eureka. I could make a cosmos again or something. A lot of people remember previous lives. It's not that uncommon, and nor is it that difficult. And of course, that's evidence, okay? That's empirical evidence. Now, the materialist is invited to go and try to debunk any particular incident, you know, where someone says they remember some great ones. One of my favorite is the one that Ian Stevenson, you know, who was a professor of psychology at University of Virginia for years, he collected them. And my favorite one there is a guy who was born in a southern part of Sri Lanka with a birthmark, a red birthmark on his neck. And when he reached an age of speaking, like, you know, 3, 4, 5, he kept saying to his parents, I'm not so-and-so, your son. I'm your previous son who did an evil thing, and I want to do something about it. And they started to shut him up. They had moved to a different province in Sri Lanka because they had had a son whose engagement was broken off with a lady, the family, for some reason, and then he got really upset and he murdered his, you know, ex-fiancée. And there was a big case and it was a scandal and so forth. And these people were doctors and they moved far away and changed the name and everything. And this kid, remember, he was the rebirth of that son and he wanted to do something. And eventually when he got big enough, he went back and he indentured himself to the other family to try to make up for the horrible damage he had done to them. And so in other words, the family got nothing out of him having that memory. He really didn't get anything out of it. He didn't get on TV. He didn't get on, you know, a Larry King or something. He just went and tried to make up for that terrible thing he had done in the previous life. So there's many, many documented cases like that where there's no motive to make, you know, write a bestseller or something, you know, and yet they do remember. So those can be case by case reviewed. And there is a great book that I like for you materialists by a lady whose name I can't remember, but you can easily find it on Google or at Amazon. It's called Spooks. And she's debunking the rebirth things. And she even goes to see these different stories of children who remember another family. And there's some really weird things that go on in America. There's a guy who kills dogs in a weight chamber, you know, and then sees if they get lighter. And it's funded by some government thing. Talk about the award, you know, the useless award. And there are things like this. She finds such things, that lady, and debunks them all. And then she tries to debunk the others, but then she gets kind of convinced in some of them. Some child, you know, who knows everybody and the way people talk. It goes to India and does this. It's very good, humorous, excellent book. And then she says, well, okay, maybe I could begin to buy into this. She says, even though her main purpose is not to. He says, but nobody could ever tell me what is the mechanism by which the memories would go from one embodiment, you know, one brain to another. How could that happen? And I've always meant to, I confess I didn't do it, but I meant to try to find her and give her a copy of the Book of the Dead, which shows how you have what we might call something like a mental gene, you know, where you're, where the way you lived in life and how open-hearted you are versus how closed-hearted and closed-minded you are sort of encodes itself in a super subtle place, like a material, an energetic molecule, but it's very super subtle, you know, super micro. And then that connects to the parental genes in a rebirth, if you're reborn as a mammal, and then therefore it's a three-gene meeting. And in the Book of the Dead, it's kind of very cute because it's, and it's patriotic for Americans and French people and Russians, because the mother's gene is, you know, symbolically thought of as red, you know, related to the blood, and the father's gene is white, related to semen, and the spiritual or mental gene is blue. So you have blue in the center of red and white. In the way the mechanism is described in the Tibetan sort of neuroscientific way of describing the mechanism of rebirth. And it's quite actually interesting and marvelous. So the empirical thing is basically really the memories. And the logical thing is that all nature has continuity. The burden of proof is on the person who would say something can become nothing, which is actually a senseless thing, acknowledged in the material world by even scientists with, by the second law of thermodynamics. You know, and since mind is some kind of energy, it's no more mysterious. Actually, in physics, energy has no mass. You know that. The difference between mass, matter, and energy is that energy has no mass. So, you know, even our mental, in our mind, where we think of billiard balls banging into each other, energy affects matter, but it has no mass, so it can't bang into it. You know, unless you multiply the speed of light and square it and make it and blow up a bomb like E equals MC squared, you know. So that's even a mystery too. So it shouldn't be that mysterious to us. After all, how long ago did Crick and Watson, sitting in their lab, actually, as it turned out later, it was revealed, somewhat stoned, discovered the double helix? That was only recently, and now that's sort of normal to everybody, but that's completely a magical thing. It's like, it's incredible. And now they're like editing genes and doing all these things. But that, you know, 30, 50 years ago, that was like, that would have been mysticism, right? People can have boundary slippage. In fact, we seek boundary slippage. Why do they go to like the cyclone, you know? There's like the entertainment parks or whatever they're called. And they go to like Ravi Shankar concerts or rock and roll, or they fall in love, or like what, everybody wants boundary slippage. That's what they're looking for. Why? Because it's a pain in the neck to be all like bounded up and I'm me and like, don't mess with me. You know, Wilhelm Reich, the great psychologist, called that the emotional plague, the person who couldn't feel streaming, you know, in their own body, and therefore they got all uptight and went around and wanted to kill somebody or something or torture them, you know. It's a terrible thing, the great Wilhelm Reich, you know. And that's why Rolfing people come and they help you slip your boundaries, you know. And you people are in California, you know about that. All you have to do is go from New York to San Francisco and your boundaries slip, I'll tell you. And you, unfortunately, you have to go back. You have to go back. You don't need acid or drugs, etc. No, you just need to go to California. And it's great here. You know, it's really nice. It's always an honor to be here with all you Californians. There's this physicist named Henry Stapp, and he really delighted me a few years ago when he mentioned about the Copenhagen interpretation. 1926, Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg. And they then announced to Einstein and all of the assembled, you know, those guys in the 20s, the physicists, you know, who later made the A-bomb and so on, with their beards, you know, and their thing, you know, and they're all sitting there in Copenhagen, and they said, you know, guys, you know, mind exists in the universe. This idea of absolute objectivity of matter is false. When you get down to a certain level of micro in the quantum world, below the wave-particle paradox type of thing, then you can't pursue objectivity because your act of observation and measurement interferes with the object because your mind is involved in it. So there is no absolute objectivity, and you can't get there. No theory will capture reality at the super-micro level, you know, where it's pure, it's on the boundary of pure speed of light, you know, the event horizon of speed of light, where mass becomes infinite, you know, right? You know that. We're a particle. You can't tell if it's a particle or a wave or whatever it is, or a rock and roll song. And those guys have a good string theory going plink, plink, you know. So point is, Einstein said famously, God does not play dice. And I refuse. I'm going to have the grand unified theory, you know. I'm not going to accept that. And he led a rebellion of those kind of theorists, you know, with their mathematics and the whole thing, because they don't want to accept that. They feel too insecure, the idea that ultimately reality itself, there's a little identity slippage going on right under our feet. Even though the A-bomb taught that to the subliminal consciousness of the whole planet, without question. That, you know, that is to say, the solid business in your own finger and the tip of your nose, the atoms there, it caught in a chain reaction, have release an energy that will pulverize you instantaneously. We all subliminally know that, you know, even though we're like, not me, I'm solid, I have a Cadillac, you know, whatever. But that there was that insecurity came in people and they don't want to do that. But actually, if they do that, then they surf their life, they can feel a little more relaxed and better, they don't have to control everything. The reason I mentioned that is that there's multiverses and things like that. These are things that the working physicists who are working on the surface of probabilities, the quantum people, and inventing things and actually doing useful things, they're the ones who conceded we can't grab it with a theory. You know, you can be reality, but you can't control it with some concept or theory, you know. But you can deal with probabilities and you can manipulate the surface in creative and therapeutic ways and helpful ways and create wonderful things, right? So they pay no attention, Henry Tsap told me, the working quantum people pay no attention to those theorists because you cannot experimentally prove or disprove their, you know, string theory, multiple, whatever. Of course there could be multiple, who knows? You know, we're all made of light, you know? We all dissolve into light, ourselves. And we can't catch ourselves, you know? But we can enjoy ourselves. It's like a surfer. Surfer, you got Californians, come on. You're riding that wave. You can't grab the wave and control it and write a theorem and then I'm going to sit this way on the wave. You do that, you'll drown. You'll be crashed into the rocks. You have to flow with it, right? So we all have to do that with reality. That's what they, 1926 they discovered that, and that's what the Buddhists discovered. Impermanence, when you discover that, it's not that you become a Buddhist. They say you enter the stream, okay? Sotapanna means stream enterer. That's the first stage of beginning to get liberated from the prison of rigid identity. Me versus you and me versus the universe, which is a miserable situation, right? If you are something absolutely different from the entire universe, who is going to win that confrontation? Do you think it's going to be you? You know, and you know, Buddhist thing is not religion. It's psychology. You're healers. It's healing. Everyone in this room thinks, and as if it was a normal and correct thing to think, that they're the center of this room. That's why everybody in this room is paranoid, because you know that nobody else agrees with you. They don't think you're the center, and not only that, they have the goal to think they're the center, and they are bugged with you that you don't agree with them. And so when you're perceiving the world like that, it's a problem. Well, how nice am I going to be? How selfish am I going to be? Or is it only intelligent to be really selfish? Or what? You know? And you'll never win that struggle. Death will get you. Sickness will get you. Your beloved will get sick of you and divorce you. You know, it will not, you know, it won't work. Right? Whereas, if you're still a little different, but it's kind of, you're related. Everyone is your relative, you know? And you're not really different. And therefore, when someone else has a success or fortune or joy, is joyful, when your friend or your roommate or your spouse or your child come home one day and they say, I'm so happy, I don't even know what's, I can't even express myself, I'm just really happy. And then you say, well, what happened to you? Did you drink someone? Are you on a manic cycle? Is there something wrong with you? You're not happy with them. And then finally, if you decide there's nothing bad that they did, they're just happy because, you know, we have a sensitivity to be happy from within our being, then you feel, well, how come I'm not happy? You feel jealous. A little begrudging, let's call it, if you like them. Let's not say jealous, that sounds so bad. But you feel like that, don't you? And actually, what? In Protestant ethic industrial societies, happiness is more or less illegal. wouldn't you say?
Unless you pay for it.
Exactly. So was it, what was the question?
That other guy in the other universe asked it. I don't even know what the question was.
So it is like that, you know. This is hard for us, you know. I've been teaching for 50 years, you know. I've been transmitting what my wife has been teaching to me, the Dalai Lama, to my students, and you know, they oh, I want to learn about Buddhism, and I want to empty my mind. I don't want to think, you know, because I have anxiety all the time when I think. So can I meditate? And all this. But that's not Buddhism. Anybody can meditate. Anybody can stop thinking. It won't help, actually, because when you start thinking again, you get anxious again. And you have to use your intelligence to understand something and learn something. And the idea that we're supposed to be so advanced, and we are the advanced civilization, and we're really civilization, and those pre-modern people, backward, underdeveloped, right? That they could have figured out something about the human mind thousands of years before us, and had actually a higher culture. That the Asian people who were conquered by the Brits and the Portuguese and the Dutch and the French might have been conquered because they were more gentle and more civilized, actually, than those weird Brits who had the horrible Yorkshire pudding that was like shoe leather, and they didn't have any spices, and they didn't have curry, and they didn't have mangoes. And they of course they had to conquer the world. You know? No diamonds, just tin, you know, and coal. And that was, therefore, the bullies of the planet are the less civilized, in fact. And, you know, even in people who study Buddhist studies, I tell my colleagues, I say, you guys don't even believe Buddha was enlightened. I know you don't. You don't think he had a higher consciousness. Why? He didn't have a PhD from Stanford. So therefore, he couldn't be more aware of reality, some aspects of it anyway, than you, right? But actually, this is something we have to learn. We are, you know, we have a long way to go, and we have to become the peaceful, the creators and the arbiters of peace that we want to be, and we can be, and we're going to be, okay? And the Dalai Lama expects us to be. And we have a ways to go. But you people are going there because you're here tonight talking about learning from dying. And actually, dying and being aware of dying brings you to life. And why do they hide death from you in an industrial society? Well, as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said, one of the pioneers of making people more aware of death in our civilization or our culture, she said, after being with 10,000 people when they died, she said, I never met a single one who deeply regretted not having spent another day at the office. She said, if you are more aware of your death, even though it may, for all of you here, be 100 years from now, but if you really face it and are aware of it and don't live in denial of it in a certain level, then you want to be alive now, you know. You don't know when it could happen, so you want to make the most of this moment, you know. That doesn't mean you're only in the moment in some irresponsible manner, like the way some people sell being in the moment. But it means you still want to make this a better moment, because you know you have a limited number of them. And being aware of death brings you very strongly to life, especially if you know that death is a doorway to a next one, and you don't want to repeat some of the mistakes you just are. I love to tell this to American audiences. You're going to fall in love with and marry your ex again and again and again and again. So don't get too vicious a lawyer and make a bad arrangement. And you're going to fall in love again. And you make a better round that. They'll have a better lawyer next time if you don't be nice now. Take it, okay, take care of it. Americans need to hear that. I like that myself. So learning from dying means learning to be more alive. And that I, you know, when I was asked by someone to retranslate parts of the Book of the Dead, when I, years ago in the 70s, in the 80s, and I didn't think it had already been translated. Why bother? But then I did. And then when I did, it was this amazing thing. The insight I got in the process of working on thinking a lot about it is there's no dead people. You know, there are no dead people. People are instantly alive in another form. So there's no dead people lurking around. There are a few people who get stuck in what's called the between state, the bardo, or the between state, because they're so obsessed about something in their past, previous life. They try to get back in their body. There's a whole thing about that, and they can be like ghostly and so forth like that. But basically, people are always going on, you know. And therefore, Tibet is very unique among Asian societies, and I think all societies, in that they don't really fuss about their ancestors. Much less, they don't have ancestor cults in Tibet. Why? Because grandpa is not sitting up there waiting for a cookie and a cup of tea in a ritual. Grandpa might be your neighbor. You might be grandpa or grandma. You might be, or grandpa. I might have been grandma. In other words, everybody's recycling, so they're coming back. So you want to save that cup of tea for your friend, because they might be your relative. It's a wonderful, the karma biology theory, the karma Darwinian theory, where the individual continues, you know, individual not in a metaphysical but a social sense continues. It's wonderful, all the byproducts that it has. Luckily, Buddhism has no absolute theory. It's a relational theory, but you have better and worse ones, true and false, valid, invalid. It's a relational matter. No theory about something is absolute. It's contextual, all theory. You know, Buddhists were aware of that hermeneutical principle thousands of years ago. So learning from dying is really good. And thinking about it, Dalai Lama himself, he practices something which we can all practice, which is six times a day, he takes like a letter. In him, it's the letter HUM in the Tibetan form, H-U-M. You can do it in English. And then what he does is he visualizes the letter unraveling, you know, the M, and then the U, and then the H from the bottom, and finally there's a little squiggle left, and then that disappears. So he, in other words, he practices rehearsing letting go. And this then makes him then, and of course he didn't die, but I'm saying that we all go through that. And actually, we all go through it every night when we fall asleep. But usually we're so exhausted because we overwork and we want to achieve and accomplish something because we're industrialized in our mentality. And so we usually just pass out. But if you fall asleep slowly, you sort of gradually lose consciousness in a certain way, and different senses get quiet in a certain sequence, and you can learn to be more aware of that, actually, and that can be a good practice. Then with great relief, you do release your consciousness. And so these are all good, boundary, these are all good practices. Dalai Lama does it all the time. That's learning from dying. And then you wake up. This is a very important thing. Actually, I teach this at, we have a Tibet house, our place in the U.S., in New York, but it has U.S. I want to make one here in California before I die, actually, a second one. But we have one in New York. And then we have a little place in the country called Menla, and there we do sort of retreats or work in weekend workshops or week-long workshops, things like that. I have a sleep meditation there that I teach everybody, and it's like kind of patented for Menla, but I'll share it. Menla means medicine Buddha, you know. But I'll share it with you guys. And that is, when you sleep, one thing that's not good about our sleeping is we have a notion, because we turn off the lights, we put earplugs if we're in a noisy place, or we go in a quiet room, soft pillow, and then we lose consciousness safely, you know. And then we do that, right, every night. But unfortunately, I think we assume that what our body is doing while we're unconscious, well, we might be dreaming, but anyway, what the body is doing when we're not paying attention to the physical body is it's lying quietly in a dark space. And we associate that subliminally with our materialist consensual reality that's the ground of being. The ground of reality is this dark nothingness, because we wrongly are thinking nothingness is there. It's something. You know, it's a cosmic, you know, you take the atom apart, there's a nothing in there, you know, which is a mistaken idea. So the Buddhists have a view of what they call the clear light of emptiness. And what it is, it's like in quantum physics, it's like something they call the zero quantum point energy field, vacuum energy field. And mathematically, there's a thing like where that quantum vacuum has an infinite potential energy, there's infinite energy. It's like, but when energy is infinite, it doesn't have to do anything because everything's already done. It's like, it's a paradox, you know, it's something they cope with in the quantum people. And so visualize before you go to sleep yes, I'm going to lose consciousness and I'm going to go into a plane of darkness at some point, which I associate with losing consciousness. But then without me noticing it, because I didn't train myself like that, I'm going to go into this zero quantum point, clear light of the void field. And that field has infinite energy, which won't do anything to me, doesn't molest or interfere with me, but every cell in my body can draw whatever it needs from that field, because it has infinite energy and can therefore share it without loss. And that's why you feel wonderful in the morning. You wouldn't feel wonderful if you were lying in nothingness. What would you get from nothingness? You'd be just as tired as when you went to sleep. But you, when you get your mind out of the way and your body really opens its boundary and relaxes, because you have no sense of boundary when you're sound asleep, and then this infinite energy underlying in the cosmos, which you could call God's love if you're a theist, or you could just call the infinite energy of the quantum zero-point field if you're a scientist. And you therefore feel really energized and ready to go in the morning, because you've gotten the clear light of the void has like pumped you up. Okay? So this is a great sleep yoga. And when people do that, they tend to pop up in the morning and they complain less about the food and the whatever, you know, at the retreat center. And they feel happy and they feel alert and energized. So try that when you sleep. Don't think of yourself as lying in darkness. Think that you leave the body alone in darkness, but then your body and brain and everything goes into this plane where there's endless positive energy. It's a big job for us Western people and modern consensual reality, whether religious or spirit or materialist. It's a big job for us to try to come up with the idea that the good is more powerful than the bad guys. We're pretty indoctrinated to think that a little bit of goodness is kind of foolish. It's like a little flashlight against the sun, you know, or against a raging fire. It's a little tiny little cup of water against a raging fire. We're really a bit depressed, actually, because we are taught to feel that. And that's why we're less active, and we should overcome that. Good is actually more powerful, you know, finally. Or we wouldn't be hanging around. Gandhi was really beautiful about that. It's in the Gandhi movie, in case you'd like to see that beautiful movie again by Richard Attenborough. And one of his things goes wrong because some people in that strike that he called, and he's fasting, they got angry and they burned down a police station and killed some police, so he calls off the fasting and, you know, it seems hopeless. An American woman who was his disciple came and said, Mr. Gandhi, don't you get really discouraged when everything you do goes wrong? That doesn't happen. And he says, no, he says, I don't get discouraged. He said, yes, those people lost control and they did something violent to the poor police people. And so we stopped the thing, he said, but what I reflect on is that the weave and fabric of human society is like a weave of kindness. In that same time that they burned down that one police station, many people restrained their wish to burn something down. Many people helped the other person, old lady across the street. They pumped some water for someone. They carried something here and there. Someone cooked for someone else. We wouldn't be doing this if different people didn't do things for each other all the time. And I just think of that vaster fabric against the surface of which these exceptional, nasty things take place. And of course, a war is the time when it seems like everything is that. But even in war, some people are cool. There's a wonderful Buddhist former life story of the Buddha that I really like, where he is, in that previous life, he's the king of the gods in their Olympus. And they have fights with the demons all the time, the titans. They're always having wars with them, because the demons are always trying to take over the heaven Olympus. You know, they always fail, but they try. So there's this one time when the king of the gods is temporarily being beaten back by the demons, and he's going through a forest trail, very narrow forest trail, running away in his chariot. And he sees an eagle nest in with the flagpole that sticks up off the wagon. And he realizes that the pole on his wagon is going to knock down the eagle chicks and smash the nest. So he screeches, tells his charioteer to screech to a halt. And he says, this is not, they're not my enemy in the war. I can't destroy those chicks. Well, just because I'm fighting with the demons. Turn this chariot around. You know? And he makes the guy turn around and says, but Your Majesty, you're going to go right back single-handedly against that army of the demons. He says, never mind. They're not part of the war. I'm not killing those eagle chicks. He says, and then he charges there. And of course, typical Buddhist happy ending story, that they think he's got all the other soldiers, that God, divine soldiers at his back, and they run away. So, but because he didn't want to harm that those little eagle chicks in the middle of a battle. And I think soldiers and people like that in battles, they do kind things in between all this and that, you know, even in war.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman during one of his intensive programs at Menlo Retreat in Phoenicia, New York, or during one of the Tibet House U.S. member trips with Geographic Expeditions in 2018. Trips this year include Mongolia and Bhutan. To learn more about these member trips, please visit bobthurman.com. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dilek.